The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1997, I did my first interview with James Lee Burke. He was on book tour for a novel called Cimarron Rose, and he came out to see me in Yellow Springs, and we did a live interview. He had an event that night in Dayton, and we just kept doing interviews over the years. We've done quite a few of them, and back in 2002, I did one with Jim on the telephone. I called him up. It was winter. It was December. And he was at his place in New Iberia, Louisiana. Now, back in those days, Jim spent 6 months of the year in Louisiana during the cold months. And then he'd spend the other 6 months in Montana. And back in those days, he went out on book tours and did what a lot of authors do. Since then, he has stopped going on book tours, and he lives full-time in Montana. I don't think he spends much time in Louisiana at all. At the time I spoke to him, back in 2002, he had just published a novel called White Doves at Morning, and this is one of my favorite books that he's ever written. It has a theme that resonates through a lot of his Dave Robichaux novels, his best-known series. The Civil War is always back in his memories, and during this interview, he talked about one of his ancestors who fought in the Civil War, and that he has this ancestor's memoirs, and he also talked about a lot of other things. He talked about his influences being dreams, that he dreams a lot of his stories, and how important that is to him. And he's just an amazing guy. This is one of my favorite interviews with James Lee Burke, recorded back in 2002 as he talked about his novel White Doves at Morning. It's the Best of the Book Nook.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I am absolutely delighted to welcome James Lee Burke back to the program. Jim, welcome.
Well, thanks, Vic, for having me on again.
When I got this book in the mail, I took one look at it, and I said, oh my, this is the book he's been wanting to write all these years. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a book I've had in mind a long time.
We were chatting a moment ago. You wrote a story for the Antioch Review a number of years ago that had a Civil War theme. What is it with the Civil War? Your people were involved in that, weren't they?
Yeah, I wrote about some of my ancestors in the novel White Doves at Morning, which just came out with Simon and Schuster. The Civil War, to my mind at least, is the most defining period in our history, probably more so even than the American Revolution. And I don't think anyone can fully understand the contemporary United States without understanding the war between the states.
You go back to 1861, right before the war, and you're exploring a landscape that's fairly familiar to you, at least the modern incarnation of it.
Uh-huh.
New Iberia? Is that the name of the town?
Yeah, that's where we live half the year, and okay. My family has lived here since 1836. But the story deals with my great-grandfather, Robert Perry, and my great-uncle, Willie Burke, and but probably the strongest characters in the book are the two women characters, a slave girl named Flower Jameson, the daughter of the owner of Angola Prison, and an abolitionist nurse from Massachusetts named Abigail Dowling, who settles in New Iberia and is in residence here during the war between the states. Almost all the characters are based on historical figures, or in a couple of cases, they're composites, I guess. But one way or another, they all have a biographical linkage to the past.
My guest is James Lee Burke. His book is White Doves at Morning. He joins us in the Book Nook today. I can remember going to first grade, and it was the centennial of the Civil War, and there was a lot of stuff going on about the Civil War, and I got hooked. I remember going to the bookmobile and pulling out every book on the Civil War that I could find, even though I never had any ancestors involved in the conflict. It just fascinates me. Were you a kid that loved the Civil War?
Oh, yes. Well, when I grew up, it was still visibly present. In 1942, I remember going down to the wreckage of a Confederate gunboat. It was submerged in Bayou Teche, and my dad pulled a big rusted spike out of one of the beams. Either the bow or the stern was sticking out of the shallows. The rest of the boat was encased in mud. But I have many balls that were recovered from a canal right outside of town here. There were a lot of battles. 20,000 federal troops marched right through New Iberia. But this story is really about the influence of the war on individuals, and particularly these women who are the best women characters I've written about. And the story centers around my great uncle Willie's teaching a black slave, Flower Jameson, to read and write. And in the book, she goes on to found a school for people of color, a school that actually existed here during Reconstruction, and that changed the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of people of color.
And these two women, Abigail and Flower, they're conflicted, yet they're very pure at heart. They want goodness. They want justice. They want liberty.
Yeah.
Abigail comes from a Quaker background.
That's right. Yeah. She comes from a pacifist family, and her father served in the Mexican War with Jefferson Davis, and he was a friend of very important and powerful people and a wealthy man. And she finds herself down here in the Deep South during the war between the states, despised by some truly villainous guys like me. And we meet the guy who founded Angola Penitentiary, and I gave him a fictitious name, but he is based on a real person. I changed a number of the names in the book because I still want to live around here. I don't want a Molotov cocktail through my front window.
Well,
this guy, Ira Jameson, though, is a really interesting character in the book. But Angola Prison, you see, was formed out of Angola Plantation, and it was it was a penitentiary that leased out convict labor, and it replaced this rental. Pardon me.
Yeah.
Oh, I apologize. I ate
That's okay,
a sausage
James.
Just before I started talking. The convict labor system replaced the system of slavery that was, of course, wiped out by the Emancipation Proclamation.
My guest is James Lee Burke. We also get a vision of the first day of Shiloh.
Yeah.
Wow. There's nothing glamorous about this war.
No, my great-uncle Willie was there, and his outfit was the 18th Louisiana, and they were at Owl Creek that was way over on the left flank, and they were ordered uphill into Union artillery with no support on their flanks, and in 15 minutes, over 40% of them were casualties. They were just decimated by canister and grape and case shot. It must have been horrible. Uncle Willie would never talk about the war. That was a tradition in the family.
Yeah. My dad wouldn't talk about World War II. I don't think it's something people want to remember.
But anyway, I think the campaigns that are described in the book are, to my mind, fairly well written. Of course,
yeah.
I'm not a neutral observer. server.
Well, I'm neutral.
There's a bias at work here.
I'm neutral, Jim, and I agree with you. My guest is James Lee Burke. His book is White Doves at Morning. He joins us in the Book Nook today. And did your ancestor, Willie, actually run into Bedford Forest, or did you make that up?
Well, he served at the same time at Bedford Forest, but he put it this way. I tried to reconstruct as well as I could the events that he was in. And so we meet Bedford Forest in here. We also meet the Union General, Nathaniel Banks, who more or less turned his troops loose on the civilian population. We also meet General Mouton, some remarkable figures. And so I tried to recreate them knowing what I do know from either tradition or from my reading. But I think the accounts are fairly accurate. The portrayal of the people and the events are fairly accurate.
Well, it's an incredibly conflicted time. It's a country fighting itself, and we have a lot of issues, and slavery is clearly a huge issue down in this part of Louisiana. And Abigail doesn't quite fit in. We actually get through the war, and using that verb reconstruct, we get into Reconstruction and the birth of the roots of the KKK. Wasn't General Forrest one of the founders of that?
That's right.
Yeah.
The Ku Klux Klan, there were several groups that grew up almost simultaneously after the war. The Ku Klux Klan was founded in Pulaski, is it Tennessee, I guess, up in northern Tennessee.
I think it is.
And the original Klansmen were actually pranksters more than anything else. They were Masons, and they donned costumes, and they put on these mock ceremonies that were rather grandiose and fairly hollow and didn't have a lot of political significance. But their nomenclature, you see, came from their Mason background, claverns and grand councils and imperial wizards, all that stuff. But it was really like a Halloween masquerade. Mm-hmm. But it quickly became an instrument of terror. In the, Maxwell House Coffee?
Yeah.
Well, that name comes from the old Maxwell House in Nashville, where the first formal meetings of the Klan were held.
Oh.
And the first Imperial Wizard or Grand Dragon was Nathaniel Forrest. But by the year 1869, Forrest ordered it disbanded because it had become an instrument of terror. But the genie was out of the bottle by then. There were two other groups, the Knights of the White Camellia and the White League. The latter was probably the most well-organized, the most military in nature. But it was they who took over the city of New Orleans in 1874. The city was actually relieved from siege by troops, partially under the command of General James Longstreet, who was Lee's second-in-command at the Battle of Gettysburg.
Oh.
It's a strange irony. But in the book, we find it's hard for people to make choices. Abigail Dowling witnesses the lynching of a Southern man from the U.S. Mint in New Orleans. That actually occurred. When General Butler occupied New Orleans, the Union general, he ruled the city with an iron fist, and he was corrupt as well. He was called Spoons Butler because he stole everybody's silverware. But he ordered that no flag be desecrated. Well, Confederate sympathizers in the city of New Orleans tore down the Union flag from the Mint and ripped it to shreds right there on Decatur Street. And one man the next day, he was a riverboat gambler, was wearing a scrap of the flag in his buttonhole, and he was arrested and sentenced to death. And with the consent of Abraham Lincoln, Butler had him hanged from the flagpole in front of the U.S. Mint.
Lincoln really signed off on that?
Lincoln signed off on that.
Oh, wow.
It was an example of great cruelty. In other words, it would probably qualify as a terroristic act. But you see, for people living in that time, for some, the choice between Union and Confederate became problematic. It's like all wars, perhaps. It's sometimes not easy to find a side that is totally in the right. Because, as I mentioned, you know, the crimes against civilians here were just like those perpetrated by Sherman in Georgia. There were, you know, homes were burned. Women were raped all up and down the bayou here. It was a lesson in terror. A lot of people aren't aware of that, but you see, this ensured the enmity that would characterize Reconstruction and which would prevail in this country well into the 20th century. Many Northerners are not aware of things that occurred here during the war and during Reconstruction. You know, there's, how did Ernest Hemingway put it? He said, "There is nothing worse than losing a war."
What war was he referring to? The Spanish-American, or
any of them?
Okay.
To lose a war ensures that a country, as a rule, will be victimized and trodden into the ground. I mean, there are exceptions. One of the great, the great historical exception was the treatment of America's enemies. After 1945, we rebuilt their countries through the Marshall Plan. It's one of the greatest acts of generosity in human history. Adlai Stevenson said that before his death. He said, "There's no precedent for what the United States did in 45.
Well, we kind of had a tradition of this. Wasn't Herbert Hoover involved in repairing Europe after World War One?
That's correct. He was head of the American Red Cross. And Herbert Hoover was a man, in all probability, of great humanity who saved the lives of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of starving Russians.
This is the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back 18 years to my 2002 interview with James Lee Burke, talking about his novel White Doves at Morning. And I spoke to him by telephone. He was in Louisiana. And as we were talking about the story and about the Civil War and about his ancestor who fought in the Civil War, I kept thinking, at the end of the interview, I need to play a song by Jack Hardy, a Civil War song. And that was in my mind, and I had one queued up to play at the end of the interview. That was just the way I felt I should program it, a great way to go out of the interview. And so I had that CD queued up, and I was ready to go when we ended our conversation. And as you'll find when we get to the end of this interview from 18 years ago, I think very similarly now as I did then. You'll see what I mean. We'll bring you more of James Lee Burke right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling at 91.3 on your radio dial. And 18 years ago, I interviewed James Lee Burke for his novel White Doves at Morning. He has made more appearances on the program than any other writer. I love his work. And at the time we did this interview, I think he was 66 years old. And I believe this was his 22nd book. Well, Jim is still doing it. He lives out in Montana, and he has written now 39 books, and the 40th one will be coming out in May. It's called A Private Cathedral, and I'm hoping to have him back on the program. Let's continue now with James Lee Burke from The Best of the Book Nook.
My guest is James Lee Burke. The book is White Doves at Morning, and he joins us in the Book Nook today. It takes place during the Civil War years, mostly in New Iberia, Louisiana, in that area.
And man, your bad guys are bad.
There's some pretty bad guys in here, but they're the real thing.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I gave the one character, Ira Jameson, far more humanity than I think his biographical antecedent would merit.
We had to be able to compare him to his lieutenants, or I should say his captain,
yeah,
and that other fella. Oh, man. They start off the book, and I'm not going to give anything away, but they're bad to the bone all the way through until the very end when the second overseer, he kind of has a little sense of remorse. But the thing that struck me is most of these guys seem to be clinically insane.
I think you're absolutely correct. I think that was a point made not only by Martin Luther King in his writings, that, namely that racism inculcated a kind of pathology in the racist, but Thomas Jefferson wrote about the same kind of debility taking place in people. They became spiritually slothful and grandiose and arrogant and ultimately effete, dependent upon the labor of others, and decadent and cruel. And Jefferson well understood what the misuse of power does to individuals.
My guest is James Lee Burke. His book is White Doves at Morning. And this book, as far as I can tell, is quite a departure for you from other projects. Do you think that's true?
Well, I've written about the Civil War indirectly for many years, but I never wrote an entire book about it. I wrote one other historical novel, Two for Texas, about the Texas Revolution. And I've written a number of short stories, one of which was in the Antioch Review.
Uh-huh.
It was titled Decoration Day, dealing with the war between the states.
Jim, as I was reading the book, the pacing is just incredible. This puppy moves.
Oh, thanks. I'm really proud of it. I think it's my best work.
I'm telling you, I have to agree. Of course, I haven't read all your other books, but tell our listeners who perhaps aren't familiar with you about some of your other work, because you have some series that you've been working on.
Well, I've been publishing a long time. I'm 66, so I published my first story in 1956 in a college literary magazine. But in that time, I've written about Kentucky. I used to work for the U.S. Forest Service. And I wrote a book titled To the Bright and Shining Sun that I'm right proud of, and I've written several of what are called literary novels and quite a few short stories and essays, but I had to keep my day job during those years.
Weren't you a social worker?
Yeah, I used to work on Skid Row in Los Angeles, uh-huh, on the south side and the east side. And I had a lot of interesting experiences with the jobs that I had, but in one way or another, they all, I think, came to bear on my writing of The Neon Rain, which was the first book in the Dave Robichaux series.
Uh-huh.
And during the middle of my career, I went 14 years, during which time I could not sell a book in hardback. It was a really long haul. And I wrote The Neon Rain, and three publishers made bids on it. And then I wrote the second book in the series, Heaven's Prisoners. And then the third, Black Cherry Blues, went up for auction. And I was able to quit teaching. Although teaching was a very good life for me. The academic world was good to me. But I was able to write full time at that point. And that was 1989, I think. Yeah, 89. I was able to, you know, do what I've always wanted to do, which is just to write. And that's what I do today. I do it 7 days a week. Just hit it and get it from morning till, from can't see to can't see.
My guest is James Lee Burke. His new book is White Doves at Morning. I remember talking to you, I think it was the last time I had you on the program, and I asked you what role dreams play in your writing. And you told me that dreams are significant to you, and I had to notice in this new book there's a whole lot of dreaming going on.
Yeah, I subscribe to the notion that the story is in the unconscious, and I would like to say that I designed all of the elements in my book or created them, but it's not true. I I believe that the story is written by a hand outside the artist. I've always believed that. I think every real artist would concede that, that his gift comes from some force or hand or agency outside of himself. But it's in the world of sleep that we explore the vastness of the unconscious. And Ernest Hemingway talked about this, and I think John Milton, in his poem titled Upon His Blindness, put it best. After Milton had lost his sight, he was devastated. But in the poem, he talks about his nocturnal hours being illuminated by his dreams and then waking at dawn to blackness. It's a great poem about the nature of the imagination. Shakespeare once said or wrote, all power lies in the world of dreams.
Wow. Well, I lost track of the dream sequences in here, and they're very brief, but lots of your characters are having dreams, and some of them are rather disturbing.
Yeah. I think Freud once, how did he put it? He was talking with someone about man's aspirations, and the friend, who was very positive, said, the human race is possessed of such great idealism. And Freud said, yes, I'm happy you've shown me the ideals of our kind, but now I'll introduce you to the basement where the monsters frolic, or something like that. Of course, I don't know. Freud had a peculiar bent sometimes. I think Freud was a great writer. Psychoanalyst. Don't misunderstand me. But, the danger of getting into Freudian psychology is you can be sitting across from someone and tapping a pencil on the table, and the guy starts to give you a readout on what you're actually thinking about. And you want to say, get a life.
Oh, my.
It's like being around a room full of academics who tear pages off of one another's notepads to figure out what their doodles meant, Hey, this guy's going to slash my pay raise.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Jim, to share the best laugh in the world of literature with our listeners out there.
Well, thanks.
It obviously comes from the heart. Do you think you're a superstitious person?
No, but of course, the old expression, one man's superstition is another man's religion. All a matter of definition. I think what it comes down to is every human being has a vision of what he conceives of as the truth. And every person forms some kind of silent contract with a power outside of himself. And once he makes that contract and he accepts that vision of the world and his concept of God and his concept of what he should be doing in the world, then he doesn't need to explain himself anymore. At that point, he steps across the line and he gets into an area that I know Catholic theologians call the fundamental option. You make a choice for good over evil, and after you make that choice, you don't worry about too much. You just let the score take care of itself and bear down on the batter one pitch at a time.
And your ancestor, Willie, kind of makes that decision, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's a great character. And I have his journals. See, he wrote all the time, and his journals are fascinating. And he was a very decent, good man, a brave soldier, a Renaissance humanist who despised demagogues and dictators, and he despised cruelty and the mistreatment of black people, and did not believe in slavery. But only about 25% of the white population in the South had a vested interest in slavery. The fact that all of these other people were involved in the army or the war really tells us there were other issues involved as well. You know, it's a complex period.
Is that the white trash issue?
Well, of course, we meet some of those guys here. The people who lived on the rim of respectable society and who later on during Reconstruction would be inculcated. Fear would be inculcated in them. They were made to be insecure. They were made to feel insecure. They were made to feel the black man, the liberated black man, was the enemy. And, do you ever see the film The Chamber, based on John Grisham's book?
No.
That film, which I don't think did very well, was the best treatment of the poor white mentality I ever saw on the screen, at least. And in there, Gene Hackman plays the role of a Klansman, a modern-day Klansman.
Uh-huh.
And he fears the black man because he detests himself. He loathes himself. And in the last scene, he's about to be executed for his crimes. And he's asked if he has anything to say, and he says, well, you know, in my lifetime, I hated many a man, but the man I hated most was myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great line.
I'll say.
And that's the way the poor whites think of themselves, with loathing.
And those poor southern whites down in Kentucky used to have a saying, what was it, the three R's?
Reading, writing, and the road to Dayton. We used to live out in the Cumberland. You know, I worked for the U.S. Job Corps and the Forest Service back in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
I knew a lot of great people. My favorite friend and one of the best men I ever knew was a moonshiner there in Menifee County, and he's passed away, but he was a noble man, and he had made perhaps 1 million gallons of sour mash whiskey, and he used to ship it up to Detroit. I mean, it was moonshine. But one day I asked him, I said, Silas, did you ever kind of have ethical qualms about, making all this illegal whiskey? And he looked at me like I'd fallen through a hole in the dimension. And he said, why, Jim, we've been breaking a man-made law. We ain't broke no God-made laws. That's solid gold.
Oh, my. 1 million gallons, that must have been quite a production.
Yeah, well, this was in the mid-60s, but there were still people cooking mash back in those hills. I still have a thumping cake that I found in a rock house there, right over Red River Gorge, there in East Kentucky. I have the mash stir, and that's the second stage on a moonshine still. It's called the thumping keg because when the steam comes off of the cooker, there's an arm that runs into this keg, and the whole affair starts to thump real loudly.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you might have been an eyewitness to some of this, Jim. I'm sure not.
Well, I knew a bunch of people who made it, or they were transporters. You see, at that time, down there in the corner of Kentucky where we had friends, they were coal miners, there were people running whiskey in from West Virginia and Virginia, what they call Old Virginia down there, of course. And they were regular transporters, and they had souped-up cars. And they would smash the lock on the trunk, but they would use a spring on the back seat that would allow the top of the back seat to flip up like a hatch, and they'd carry their booze in there. But they didn't bring moonshine in; they just brought in liquor, and would sell it illegally in the dry counties, of course, and they'd get everybody, all their relatives, to vote dry every time the referendum came up. So, but East Kentucky years ago was still, in many ways, quite primitive. You know, people right down the holler from us lived in dirt floor shacks with maybe a Coleman lantern for heat, without any plumbing, no electricity. We used to see the kids down there in a place called Snaky Holler walk barefoot in the snow in clothes made out of Purina feed sacks. This was 1965.
Oh, my.
I mean, it was just as primitive as life gets.
And that's when LBJ decided to have the war on poverty, huh?
Yeah, and it did a lot of good for people. I remember my little boy, we lived way out on the rural route, and the county seat was only 350 people, and we lived about 10 miles from there. And my little boy went to the Head Start program, and he came home the first day, and he was so perplexed, and he said there was another little boy on the bus who washed his hands in the toilet because he didn't know what it was. He thought it was a laboratory. And a lot of those kids had never seen plumbing, and they had never had eggs for breakfast. But see, that was not that long ago. And you know, I hear people run down liberals, oh, God Almighty, they love to do it. And I always want to ask them, what is it you have against Social Security and minimum wage and workman's compensation and protection of the environment and the consumer and public education and vocational training? What is so odious about these things? Please explain that. But nobody ever asked the question.
it's too obvious.
Anybody who wants the good old days can revisit Kentucky 40 years ago. The federal programs did a lot of good for a lot of people.
My guest is James Lee Burke. The book is White Doves at Morning. And is this your 21st novel?
Yeah, I think it is. Okay. 21 or 22nd, I forget.
What are you up to? What are you working on? You working on anything?
Yeah, I'm working on a Dave Robichaux novel right now, and it'll be out in October of 2003.
And you going to stay out of Montana for the winter?
Yeah, we'll go back up in the spring. We kind of bounce back and forth. Uh-huh. You know, we're real fortunate. We live in two lovely parts of the country.
Don't you drive a big old mobile home?
No.
How do you get around?
Oh, I have a Toyota. I got a pickup truck, and I got an Avalon, and I travel with the angels flying low.
And I'm guessing that your wife is a big part of all this.
Oh yeah, we've been married. Next month we will have been married 43 years. That's right. She's from Beijing, China, and used to fly as a stewardess for civil air transport. That was the Flying Tiger Airline. The original guys used to be the pilots, and that was back in the 50s. That airline became Air America, and I was married to my wife for 30 years before I knew that I had married a CIA operative, you know, because Air America was a CIA front. That's what I call deep cover.
Man. Well, Jim, we'd love to have you back next time that next book comes out. And is that one also going to be on Simon & Schuster?
Yeah. In fact, I'd love to be on your show again because I'll be on the tour next fall. And I think we go to Kentucky, and we go to Dayton.
Oh, great.
And we go to those Joseph Beth bookstores, you know, that chain in the Upper South.
Sure, there's one in Lexington that's very nice.
That's right. And, we go to Cincy and Louisville. That's always a great part of the tour. I love, you know, Ohio and the Valley and in Kentucky. It's great country.
Well, we'll be watching for you in the fall, Jim.
Well, thanks for everything, Vic. It's great talking to you again.
I work on my list in December of my favorite books for the year, and I was pretty much finished with it, and then I read your book, and I'm like, oops, got to bump somebody.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, yeah. It's discounted 40% at all the stores on the Internet.
Is it?
I can put in a plug for myself.
Okay. Well, Jim, it's always a treat, and you have a really great winter and good holidays.
Well, have a Merry Christmas, Vic, and thanks for everything.
Hey, stay on the line. We've got some Civil War music up next. This is Jack Hardy.
You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and as you heard there, I was getting ready to play a song by Jack Hardy, and that interview was recorded 18 years ago with James Lee Burke. I talked to him on the telephone in Louisiana about his novel White Doves at Morning, and I had not listened to this interview again until just the other day when we got it digitized and I played it back. And as I was listening to it, I kept saying to myself, I need to play a song by Jack Hardy about the Civil War at the end of this because we're going to have a little extra time.
And I kept saying that to myself. And then I got to the end of the interview and I said, "This is Jack Hardy on WYSO. I thought exactly the same way 18 years ago as I did now. I've got to have a song by Jack Hardy about the Civil War at the end of the interview. So we're going to bring you a song by Jack Hardy right after this." The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. At the beginning of the program, we brought you an interview with James Lee Burke, recorded back in 2002 for his standalone novel, White Doves at Morning. And over all the interviews I've done with Jim, that stands out to me as one of my favorites. And so does that book, White Doves at Morning. If you haven't read it, it's worth tracking down. It's a wonderful novel by James Lee Burke. And I close that interview by playing a song from a CD by the songwriter Jack Hardy, who visited the program 3 years before that. Back in 1999, Jack Hardy was in Yellow Springs. And it was a strange thing that he was here because he really didn't have any reason to be here, except there was someone in town, and I don't know who this person was, who was an artist who was designing the CD cover for an upcoming CD by Jack Hardy. And so he came to town, and a good friend of his contacted me and said, "Jack Hardy's in town. Do you want to have him on your program?" And I said, "I love Jack Hardy. Send him over." So Jack Hardy came by, and he recorded some songs and played live, and we heard him do a song about the Civil War. Let's listen now. Here's Jack Hardy going back to 1999.
What kind of song would you like? What are you in the mood for?
I'm a big Civil War buff. Don't you have some Civil War stuff?
There's a few of them, you know.
It's up to you. Whatever you want.
Yeah, I could do a Civil War song. This was, came from Sherman's March. He had his army divided into a three-prong attack. The northern wing was under a general with the ironic name of Jefferson Davis, and he was also an avid pro-slavery man. And one particular creek crossing, Ebenezer Creek, he ordered that the pontoon bridges be taken up after the army crossed and abandoned several hundred recently freed slaves to the Confederate cavalry. There was later a congressional inquiry into the incident, but we know what happens to those. Turns into a folk song. Freedom plan. For days we'll follow the wagons with all we own on our backs. That long blue winding dragon with the fire and death in its track. But the pontoon bridge is gone. Bummers meant freedom. That promise made good at last. That 47-year promise. Why then do they turn us back? And they have warned us not to follow too close behind the guns. The fighting up front is heavy when it hasn't even begun, but the pontoon bridge is gone. And some say the avenging angel has turned upon its own. And all this talk of freedom is just Sherman's marching song. And some are pleading Jesus, asking what have they done wrong. Running up and down that riverbank, flailing their arms in song. But the pontoon bridge is gone, and Sherman's troops have gone. Some soldiers disobey orders to help build rafts of logs, but they sink as oft as float, and time is running out. And rumors of Wheeler's cavalry to ship us back to the farms, or shoot us here right where we stand, helpless and unarmed. But the pontoon bridge is gone, and Sherman's troops have gone. All been read, and talk of a change in Washington, of a dream shot through the head. And some say Ebenezer is a cursed name for a creek, and some say Jefferson Davis blessed name to speak. But the pontoon bridge is gone, and Sherman's troops have gone, and freedom now is gone.
Jack Hardy, live in our studios here at WYSO. And I felt like I was going back about 140 years there. I just really felt that mood that was set by that song, just kind of a desperate feeling.
Yeah, I haven't played that one in a while. That's a fun one.
Love that.
And I still love that music by Jack Hardy, the late Jack Hardy. That was recorded back in 1999, his Civil War song. And I put that on as a special Best of the Book Nook bonus after my 2002 interview this morning with James Lee Burke for his novel White Doves at Morning with a Civil War theme. And don't miss the Book Nook tomorrow, coming up at 10:30 Sunday morning. It's the number one book right now. I just checked on Amazon.com, the number one book. So since Amazon sells more books than anybody, I'd say it's the number one book in the country. A lot of people are reading it. It'll be number two this week on the New York Times list, its debut on the list. It just came out, written by David Enrich. The book is called Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an Epic Trail of Destruction. It's quite a story. Deutsche Bank, very much involved in the financial history of our president, and just an amazing tale. We'll talk to David Enrich about it. The hottest book in the country, coming your way in the Book Nook tomorrow morning at 10:30. Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an Epic Trail of Destruction by David Enrich. In the Book Nook, 10:30. Put it on your calendar tomorrow morning, Sunday morning, right here on WYSO.